a long time introducing her, and I think I probably won't. I think we'll get right down to talking. Let's just say that she has been performing since 1961, when she first came to the United States, and began, as I understand it, kind of by accident. I don't think she was really intending to embark upon this career, but embark upon it she did. She lived here in the United States for 15 years, and then in 1976 she returned to live in Scotland on a permanent basis. She has recorded over 20 albums. She has performed widely in the United States and in Europe. She is now a singer in residence at the University of Stirling in Scotland, and at the moment is in residence at Unit 1 on the U of I campus, and she is conducting workshops on the performance and history of British and American traditional music, and spending time with students, and going around to various other classes and being interviewed, and I understand keeping quite busy. And I'm pleased that you could come in and give us some of your time.
Well, it's nice to be here.
Let me give our telephone number as well, because people might want to talk with Jean Redpath. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free in Illinois, 800-222-9455. I think when I spoke with you last, I'm not even sure how long it's been. Has it been 2 years or has it been 3 years?
I don't remember. Probably two. I'm told I've been at Cranach twice in the last... that this was the third time inside 4 years, so that would probably mean...
Maybe 2 years.
2 years ago.
I think one of the first things that I asked, and I want to have you talk about it again, because it's, I think the distinction may be important. Someone, before I did the interview with you, someone reminded me that I should not refer to you as a folk singer.
I noticed that, yes. I was quite impressed.
And that rather, I should say, traditional. And I think that I asked you about that, and I'm going to ask about it again. In your mind, what's the distinction between those two things, the difference between a traditional singer and a folk singer?
Well, I don't think it's crucial what the difference is in my mind, but it's been borne home to me many times that in other folks' minds, a folk singer can mean almost anything from Appalachian unaccompanied 85-year-old to James Taylor, Michael Jackson. You know, if you can't call it anything else, if it's not obviously jazz or obviously leader, then folk singer does, you know, at a pinch, so it doesn't really mean anything very much to a large segment of people, so I avoid it like the plague.
Hmm. Then what does traditional music mean, or traditional singing?
That too is, you know, the longer I live and the more I sing, the less I am inclined to put any kind of label on anything. I like to sing. It's an easier form of communication for me than talking, despite the amount of the latter that I do frequently. And it's also easier for many people to listen to, because it doesn't require immediate response, at least verbal response. But what does it matter whether it's Scottish traditional or French art song or American contemporary, if it's communicating, if it's reaching, you know, the audience or the group at the moment?
Well, now, how in your repertoire, how much of that is music that has been sung for a long time, and how much of it is newer, say, music that's been written within the last few years?
Proportionately, I would be hard-pushed to tell you. Right off the top of my head, probably two-thirds traditional, which means either anonymous or at least two generations. I don't know that anybody has actually defined when a song ceases to be singer-songwriter, because we know perfectly well who wrote things like "Will You Know Come Back Again," but she died in 1845. Does that mean that it's not traditional because we know who the author is? Mm. It doesn't have to be anonymous. If it's stood the test, if it's gone into popular repertoire and people will sing it without first quoting their sources, I guess that's as good a reason as any to call it within the oral tradition. About two-thirds of the stuff I work with would be traditional, and the rest in some other category, whatever it might be.
Well, when I heard you sing on Saturday night at here on the U of I campus in the Cranach Center, and you, for example, you sang a song that you said had been sent to you by someone. And by the saying that, I don't want to encourage anybody to start songs. I'm sure that's the bane of a lot of performers' existence. People will send them songs. But this happened to come on a cassette, I guess, with some others, and many of them you liked and are singing. And you sang that, and of course you're singing some traditional Scottish songs. When you look at the say something by Robert Burns or something that's maybe even older, and you don't know who wrote it. It's just something that has been passed down, and many people have sung, and you were singing. If you take that and set it aside, a song that's been written by someone contemporary, say this person who wrote this song that arrived in this packet with the others, what is in common with? What is it that those two things share in common? That there must be something about them that strikes a chord in you that says, yes, I want to sing both of these songs, and it doesn't matter to me if this one is very old and this one was written last week. What is the thing that they both share?
You've got it right there, but I don't know what you call it. You said strike a chord, I say ring a bell. If they ring the right bells in my head, it's immediately obvious to me that I need to learn the song so I can sing it. But I have been trying for 25 years to define what that is, and I have no idea what it is. It has a lot to do with the melody. I mean, if it's a poor melody, you don't have a vehicle for the story. I think it's easier to sing weaker words to a strong melody than it is to sing powerful words to a weak melody. But apart from that kind of distinction, the package, and also, of course, the performer. I can find myself very moved by a performance of a song by a particular singer, and get a hold of it, work it out, try singing it, and think, I can't do that. You know, it just doesn't work for me. It worked on the incoming line, but it is not going to work on the outgoing line. So it does sometimes. Sometimes it takes a little bit of time to discover that. Also, sometimes songs don't wear well. There are a few that one grows into and a few that are exciting for the first two or three performances, and you think, well, I've done that. Hmm. Maybe you just sort of develop beyond them or something. I don't know what one would call it. The response is instinctive, emotional, subjective, and it's certainly nothing that I can define in short words.
Okay. Well, let's talk with someone. Here we have a caller on our toll-free line. We encourage other people, if you'd like to speak with our guest, Gene Redpath. The telephone number here, 333-9455. Toll-free in Illinois, 800-222-9455. Here's someone right here on our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I refer to an incident which happened to me when my aunt, who came from Northern Ireland, who called herself Scottish, really, was in the hospital. I went to see her, and I took some cookies, and one had a name on it, and she grabbed that, and she said, that's Lorna Doone. Now, I want to know if there, it was really such a person as Lorna Doone. I'll hang up and listen.
a literary figure, I guess, Walter Scott, and somebody has used the romantic connotation, which with so many people, you will have a half-remembered notion of a story or a person or a situation, and when you're marketing something, it's invaluable to be able to plug into that, you know, that kind of subliminal association with something romantic. So Lorna Doone shortbread cookies have been around for a good long time, but whoever started to package them was thinking in terms of a Scottish mystique. I tend to refer to that kind of approach as applying a Shirley Temple lens to all sorts of things. A nice, blurry kind of romantic edge around them, which doesn't have any specific application to reality. But yes, there was a literary figure and a romantic associations that were fairly cleverly used for marketing. Mm. She certainly was not baker and purveyor of cookies, that's for sure. But the biggest problem I have with names, with Scottish association, of course, is singing something like a perfectly respectable, fairly elderly, I mean, 150 years is young for a ballad, and Lizzie Lindsay has been around longer than that and has become a shorter popular song, and there's nothing at all wrong with the song, there's nothing comic about it, it's the inevitable story of, you know, will you marry me? No, I'm betrothed to somebody else, but you're betrothed to me, can't you remember? Oh, it's you, of course I'll marry you. No, that sort of improbable storyline. But the line which destroys the song in this country now is My father is Laird O'Kinkassie. My mother is Lady the same, and I am Lord Ronald MacDonald. To speak it, I never think shame. And there is, you know, at best, a polite titter runs round the hall, and if it's youngsters, they just crack up. And as a song is destroyed by a commercial name, which takes precedence over any early reference. So.
Yeah. Many of the songs that you sing will be, to some degree, impenetrable to those of us who, as you put it the other night, are Scottish language impaired, even though I think you do a pretty good job of trying to explain to people what songs are about and what various words mean. Mm-hmm. There's no way that an American is going to understand and experience the song the way a Scot would. And I wonder if that's at all frustrating, or if sometimes you wish that audiences that really come to hear you and appreciate you and your music and your voice and everything could at the same time understand a little bit better what you're singing about.
I get asked that a lot, and I don't think it's a problem, because the actual storyline, the actual vocabulary, yes. And what I've done at this stage, I think, is use those as an excuse to pound all sorts of pulpits. I mean, I have axes I'm grinding, particular axes I'm grinding, and I think maybe what I'm trying to do is suggest that we have a great deal more in common than we have national or individual peculiarities. The emotion doesn't change. People, particularly if it's the heavier end of the emotional spectrum, people experience sadness and loss in the same way anywhere in the world, and I think can respond to a song talking about that. As far as the comedy, which tends to come in broadscots, is concerned, that just plain gives me a chance to have a good time, to try and draw some kind of word pictures of how I see the Scot, if there is such a creature, if you can define such a creature, how I see the country, how I respond to our weaknesses and our strengths. In other words, I'm an undercover agent for the Scottish Tourist Board, basically. But no, I don't think the language is a problem at all. And if you subscribe to the notion that Scots, because of the language and the country and the climate and the geomorphology, have a different experience of the world, and therefore it's impossible to have somebody in Champaign, Illinois, do that, you could equally well take that down to the finest possible distinctions and say that no two people can experience the world in the same way. That's a given. I think we spend most of our life trying to cross these particular gaps, however small or however wide they might be. I don't find it a problem, no.
Is there a difference, do you think, in the way audiences react here and in Scotland?
Yes. But I don't know that it has anything to do with an ability to respond, you know, to know what I'm saying, rather a conditioning. I think Scots are still incredibly inhibited. Again, I make fun of the fact that from Fife, for instance, we are accused of being very, very tight. Monetarily speaking is what's intended, but that also extends into an emotional field. You don't part with anything. You don't part with money, you don't part with information, you don't part with reactions. It's a very controlled. I'm not quite sure where it comes from. I have all sorts of theories about it, but again, on the most basic of levels, if you think about a cold, damp climate, you tend to keep everything closed up, weather tight, water tight, wind tight, and that might very well wash over onto keeping your top button fastened, keeping your lip fastened, you know, just whereas in warm Mediterranean climes, the clothing is loose, the emotions are a little less tightly reined. There is a kind of climatic personality, and most northern types tend to be much more restrained than, you know, the Latin personality. The Nordic personality is much more restrained than the Latin personality. As a result, of course, I think the music is that much more powerful, because it's one of the few avenues that we have to pour emotion into, and it's become quite intense, almost too intense at times.
Yeah. I think we have somebody else here on our toll-free line. Do we? Is there a caller there? Well, I guess maybe not. Maybe Mike and my director can check on that. Maybe I will also remind you that we're talking this morning with singer Jean Redpath, and if you would like to speak with her, our telephone lines are open here locally in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free in Illinois, 800-222-9455. As you were growing up, what was the place of music in your family?
Two things I would say about that. It was always there because my mother sang a lot around the house, which is why, of course, I picked up the material. And my father did quite a bit of singing in the car, for instance, if we were driving around. He played the hammer dulcimer, so I was very much aware of it. But I also picked up reinforced attitudes which are common still in Scotland, that the homegrown isn't worth much. In other words, if I had asked the formal question of either parent anywhere into my teens, what's good music, it would have had nothing at all to do with the songs that we were singing in the house or the tunes that were being played. This is one of the less attractive and, I suppose, hardest to explain traits in Scotland, tremendous national pride and a dreadful ability to self-denigrate. So that music was there, yes, but by the age of 20, music for me, with a capital M, was still something that belonged between 3:15 and 4 on a Thursday afternoon in the music room. And was usually English art song or an attempt to learn to read staff notation, which I resisted violently and never did master, and things like that. But there was a lot of traditional music around. My mother was one of 12, and everybody in her family played something all by ear, you know, mouth organ, piano, button accordion. So there was a lot of stuff around, but they didn't set any great store by it. So I really had to... I basically had to leave the country. I've been advocating that all Scots be shipped abroad for 2 years in early and deformative years. It gives you a very different and very fresh perspective on your own culture.
Does that somehow make you appreciate your own roots more?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Nothing more basic than the language, for instance. The educational system in general, and individual teachers in particular, tried very hard to get all of us to lose any regional Scottish accent that we might have. The implication, of course, was very clear without it being spelled out, that if one wanted to be regarded as educated and socially acceptable, first you had to sound English. And all I had to do was step off a plane over here, and the accent is the biggest natural gimmick I could have asked for. I mean, there are all sorts of things built in there. I don't know if you've ever noticed, but if you have a broad accent, then you are automatically probably harmless. You're slightly hard of hearing and probably not too bright. And it really is a very advantageous position to start from, because it means that people are not threatened by you and are happy to help. The first momentary hesitation of, you know, what do you want from my life when I stop a stranger, as I frequently do, because I'm nearly always lost. You know, I always know where I'm going, but don't know how to get there, so I'll stop and say, excuse me, can you tell me? And that first momentary hesitation when you stop a total stranger, especially since it's a woman on her own, what does she want from me? The minute they hear the accent, you can see the brows clear, like, she's obviously harmless, she talks funny. So it does help, but that, you know, that in itself is something that we have been fighting for a long time in Scotland, and can't really blame anybody else for it. It doesn't matter what somebody does to you, you don't have to go along with it, but we have this nasty self-flagellation built in somewhere along the line.
Well, when you came to the United States, you certainly weren't coming here to start a singing career. Maybe it was just the case that you were interested in getting away from home and seeing another place. When you came here, what were you thinking about?
Probably the honest answer to that is nothing, apart from, you know, the incredible guilt of having dropped out of university 27, 8 years ago. That was quite a step to take. It wasn't lightly done, I must say, but it caused me a good deal of grief for a little while, that having been, you know, in quotes, given the opportunity that, you know, the previous generation, especially women, didn't have, etc., how could I throw it away, rackety, rackety, rack, when basically there was absolutely nothing wrong with my instincts. Probably the best thing I've ever done, and if I went back to that age knowing what I knew now, I'm not sure if I would have the guts to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, security creeps up on you in middle years, and it gets harder and harder to swim upstream. But I don't honestly think that I had any great scheme, great life plan in mind. It was sort of explosive, immediate, impulsive, instinctual, and a very good thing.
Well, when did you start thinking about making a career of singing?
About 10 years after I did it. I think it's one of these things that suddenly presented itself to me as a fait accompli. I didn't sit down and agonize about I shouldn't be driving cars, babysitting and scrubbing floors with the kind of education and intelligence that I've gotten thus far, do something a little more worthwhile. I stumbled into it because it sounded like fun. It was something I was interested in. It was a repertoire I already had, gave me a chance to travel, and from there it gathered momentum, and 10 years later I realized this was no longer a stopgap. I was in it right up to my ears.
Yeah. We're talking with Jean Redpath. She's a Scottish traditional singer. She is currently in residence at Unit 1 on the U of I campus, and she will be here through the end of the week. She gave a performance this past weekend at the Cranert Center on the U of I campus. And
I wasn't listening earlier on when I was talking. Did I see Stevenson or Scott when I was accusing somebody of writing Lorna Doone? It's Stevenson, of course, but I don't know what
I think
came
you
out.
Said Scott.
Well, shame on me.
I should know.
There are more than two writers in Scotland, but Walter Scott has a great deal to answer for, because he's practically single-handedly responsible for how people see the Scot. You know, the whole Highland dress bit was pretty well a marketing pitch that he came up with for the royal visit to Scotland in 1822, so I tend to have it in for him. His mind is, his name is head of the pile, but Robert Louis Stevenson, of course, is the author of that.
Well, people do, when people think of Scotland, I'm sure that's the first image that comes. Mm-hmm. Kilts and bagpipes and all of that stuff that's certainly part of the culture of Scotland, but only one part, and it's part of one region and what's going on there, but there are a lot of other kinds of Scots, and they don't all wear kilts and don't all play bagpipes.
It's less than a quarter of the country, actually, from where I stand, because it's Highland and I'm a Lowlander, and it's purely male. That image is purely male, which wipes out, you know, all of the Lowlands and all of the women, which doesn't, you know, it's not wildly representative when you think about it. But there is absolutely no way that such a strong visual image is ever going to be ignored. There is no national dress for a woman in Scotland. Hmm. The kilt is a male dress. And although there are many, many women pipers around now, it also started out as very much a male domain, playing of the war pipes. There are now many people playing the other kinds of pipes which are in Scotland. You know, there are two or three other versions of pipes in Scotland, including something called the called windpipes. It's produced by bellows rather than by lungs. You can imagine if you blow into a windpipe to fill a bag, then it's obviously blood temperature, it's mm-hmm. lung temperature. Mm-hmm. So these would be warm or hot wind, though they're never referred to as such. But the ones like the Irish pipes where you're pumping a bellows with your elbow are called the called windpipes. Less powerful, much sweeter sound, and therefore possible to sing with. Whereas obviously people who say to me, do you never sing with the bagpipes? Have never been in an enclosed space with a set of war pipes. You know.
They're outdoor instruments.
Oh, indeed, yes. And preferably the other end of the block. They can affect your eardrums for quite some time.
We have several people to talk with
okay.
here. Let's do that. Line number one is next. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'd like to tell Jean that I've seen her perform several times, and that I really enjoy her music. And besides owning almost every album she has, I'm also part of a reenactment group that does 18th century reenactments. And when she was mentioning about the bagpipes being outdoor music. Oh, don't I know. What I'd like to comment on was in your performances, when you do the live shows, you do something that is not so much on your albums, and that is almost all the time you have at least one or maybe two secular type of songs as opposed to just more folk type songs. And I was wondering if you would ever consider, I realize that when you want the audience to sing along with you, you get your largest response out of Amazing Grace, or not even Amazing Grace, but other, you know, secular songs. Do you ever think that maybe that could be offending some of the audience who are not of the religious persuasion?
No, it never occurs to me that anybody would be offended, basically because no offense is intended. And I think the only way you can operate in this world is if you're out to stand on somebody's toes, then there has to be malice aforethought.
If I didn't have
irreverence or offense in mind, then there is nothing I can do about somebody else's tendency to read it in. You could finish up speechless if you carried that particular mental attitude to its ultimate conclusion.
Do you think that you could get that same type of response? You know, I think what you're looking for in doing these kind of things is to get everybody in the audience involved. You know, and let's be honest, those kind of songs a lot of the people either know or they feel comfortable with, and they do sing along real well. Do you think that if you would incorporate maybe one or two of the kind of traditional old Scottish songs in your repertoire, that you could get that same response?
No, is the short answer to that.
You really don't?
No. If I understand you, you're suggesting that, my main aim is to sing, I call them God songs, and I realize that that makes some people bridle too, but as far as I'm concerned, that's as descriptive a generic term covering every conceivable kind of religious persuasion as anything else. There's a very real reason for my using those, because it touches something a great deal deeper in most people than I could hope to do by singing what is essentially foreign language material. Yes, I can teach a Scottish song. Yes, I can teach a chorus. But as we were talking about here a couple of minutes ago, an American audience's reaction to a Scottish song is going to be not too subtly different from a Scottish audience. You don't bring the same lifetime of emotional connotation to it. And unless you are absolutely militant atheist, then you do bring some kind of personal association to a God song. Whatever your persuasion, whatever your background, whatever your belief, you do have some kind of association. And
I'm not saying that the association isn't there. I'm just thinking that for perhaps a Jew or for a Muslim who is interested in other music and would feel maybe left out is more the term I should use while you're doing a song of that nature?
I would hate to think so, but by the same token, there isn't a sermon involved. I'm not proselytizing.
I know, but you are getting an extremely round response to a song that would, you know, mention Jesus or have reference, therefore.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? I'm wondering if you don't do a song like a Scottish type of melody that, say, everybody would know, such as Scotland the Brave or Bonnie...
I've got an excellent answer for you there.
What?
A, I love Amazing Grace. I think it's a wonderful song. B, I love I Will Guide Thee. C, I love Gimme Just a Little More Time. And D, I hate Scotland the Brave. There's absolutely no excuse for me to sing a song I can't stand.
Oh, no, I can understand.
Well, most of the popular ones, unfortunately, have been done to death, and I also think most of the very well-known Scottish songs subscribe to an image of Scotland that I want touched with a barge pole. Well, I think we have an insoluble here, actually. I understand I've had a couple of people in the past, and I mean literally a couple, who have been outraged by my singing of a Moody and Sankey hymn or a black or white Baptist song. I can only repeat again that if I am singing it from a view of, you know, what I regard as an honest presentation in an attempt to communicate with the largest possible number of people in the hall, that's all I can ever do. I can never hope to reach everybody in the hall in exactly the same way.
I understand. I do want to leave you off with the feeling that I do love your music, and I think you have a lovely voice, and I really appreciate, how do I say, appreciate the albums, and I've been able to reach these.
Well, thank you, and thanks for calling in.
Thanks very much. We have a couple of other people here. Something I just wanted to ask you real quick that I'm curious about. Over the years, I wonder if various sorts of voice teachers or voice professionals have approached you and said that you were doing something wrong, and they wanted to fix you. Have said, you know, if you will study with me, then we'll take care of something, and we'll make you a great singer. Or, you know, have people over the years said, you're not getting it quite right, that you should be doing something different?
Not in the last 15 years, no.
No one's had the nerve. Huh? Just give them that look like you just gave
That's
me.
Right. This is, a perennial discussion, and, you know, I go out of my way to indicate that I was lucky in that who knows what drive kept me with traditional music, and that I mentioned the arbitrary age of 20, that when I reached 20, I still thought of music as being that shape in a small square box of a certain kind. That's because the education system conditioned me that way. It had to be innate perversity that kept me from going with the flow. But I did approach somebody at the age of 20 and say, I think I'd like to have my voice trained. And one of the things in my life that I really can claim no credit for, and I do think that there is a miserable tendency on the part of many Scots to claim credit for what they have done with their time, their energy and their talent. I'm not doing what I'm doing now by sheer dumb luck. There's been a lot of hard work and a lot of decisions involved, and I'm aware of that. There's nothing wrong with it. That's comes from being a member of the human race. But asking the right woman at the age of 20 to train my voice was something I had no control over, and she said to me, what do you want to train it to do? So that at a very early age I was asked, you know, what are your definitions? What are you going to do with it? What, you know, where are your priorities? And I think I was saved from becoming a singer of bel canto or a leader or art song or anything else, because I do think that once you have developed certain techniques, you can't backtrack. You can't then become an unself-conscious producer of voice. And it's luck that I was given the instrument and the breathing ability. It's luck that I asked the right woman, who said, if that's what you're interested, go sing for 20 years, you're not doing anything wrong, and your breathing hasn't been got at. But it is also something I accept personal responsibility for, that I've spent 20 years working on it. Generally speaking, most voice teachers, once in a while somebody will say, oh, I would love to hear you sing, you know, whatever their love is, whatever. But generally speaking, what will be said, and not too grudgingly, is that you are doing a lot of things that I'm trying to get some of my students to do, and you seem to do them naturally. I think mostly because I never thought about it. And, you know, if you don't wonder whether or not you're going to be able to jump that distance, you know, get from stone to stone, the chances are you'll do it. It's when you start to worry about whether that step is too high or whether the water's too deep, that's when you're in trouble. And for who knows what reason, I never wondered about whether or not I could produce that sound.
Do you have young people coming to you and saying, can you teach me to sing like you?
Oh, sure.
And can you?
No. Good God, no. I wouldn't want to either. They should sing like them. They shouldn't sing like me. And they, you know, the other question is, I'd love to do what you're doing, to which my response is, no, you probably wouldn't. And the formula that I've come up with in the last few years to answer this one, apart from, you know, how can I do what you're doing, or what do you suggest? My suggestion is don't, But on a much more serious level, if you have any choice, then you shouldn't go into this kind of a lifestyle. It's bizarre. But if you don't have any choice, then you're very lucky.
Well, we've been talking here, and I've been keeping callers waiting patiently.
Shame on you.
Let's get back to the phones here. Toll-free line next. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
I just wanted to ask, I haven't heard you mention, was Jean on the Prairie Home Companion as guest singer?
I sure was, yeah, many times.
Enjoyed you so much.
Well, thank you.
And I just want to add, the caller before, don't change the songs, your voice, your thought, your heart. We just love you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you. We have about 10 minutes left. We're talking with Scottish singer Jean Redpath. Our telephone number here is 333-9455. That's in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free in Illinois, 800-222-9455. Someone here on another local line, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Ms. Redpath, can you talk a little about your visit with the Unit 1 students, your reaction and theirs? And what do they seem to be interested in?
Ah, that's a wide one. My reaction is that it's unique in my experience. I've never come across anything quite like it before. I think it's a marvelous idea. Those are very, very stimulating and very interested students over there. I suspect in the long run, at the end of 2 weeks, I'm going to get a good deal more out of it than I'm putting into it. But then I'm in a position to judge that. I don't know what they're going to get out of it. The notion that they can be in sort of daily and fairly close contact with such a diverse group of people from every conceivable walk of life in the course of an academic year is something that I envy them in retrospect. I think it has to be much more valuable as pure education than many's a course that one could take. The subjects we're covering, one of the things that I found momentarily dizzying was that I am used to residences, I'm used to teaching summer school, I'm used to doing workshops, but obviously they tend to be concentrated on traditional music, on the ballad, on the works of Robert Burns, in other words, the field that I am particularly interested in myself. And of course, what it turns out that these kids are looking for is, well, how do you feel about such and such coming from your particular point of view? And as of last Monday, when I was first introduced to them, once I had talked for a while and sung for a while and just generally given them a chance to find out who I was and how I thought, we then asked for suggestions of what they would like to do. And the workshops that we came up with were really quite weird and wonderful. The notion, for instance, that I all of a sudden have become history. What was music like in Greenwich Village in the 60s? And of course, that's not desperately long for me. I've got an unbroken line of continuity since the folk revival in the 60s. But it came as quite a shock to realize that a lot of these students weren't born until 1970. So that, you know, I'm discussing a historical era practically for them, which is a real turnaround. It's difficult to know what will happen with the things still coming, but one of the things that I've been doing is a half hour every afternoon of just, you know, come in and sing an arbitrary choice of three or four songs just to see what it feels like. You don't ever have to sing them again, you don't have to memorize them, but it does make a difference if you are aware that people who worked in jute mills could sing about how miserable their life conditions were, that there are anti-war songs that are 300 and 400 years old, as well as the contemporary ones, that people have been aware that it wasn't the most intelligent thing to do to bump each other off. It really is a case of just rubbing shoulders over dinner, over lunch, over a foreign song, and interreacting. And as I say, it's been a total education for me. My hat's off to the university and to Alan Hall for having kept this program going for 13 years. I think it's great.
Does that get at your question?
Yes. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Good. I'd like to get back to talking a little bit more about performance. I have now seen you twice, and the two performances were rather different, at least in the sense that the first time was completely solo. Mm-hmm. It was just you by yourself. And then most recently with a cellist and a fiddler.
Mm-hmm.
And I gather you've been performing with them in public more and more.
Well, Abby and I have worked together on records for 14 years, and have done performances. She's a little more flexible, I guess, particularly in the East. We've done a lot of concerts together over the years. Alistair also has an independent career. That's the problem, you know. If you're working as a solo act and booking many months ahead, it's a logistic problem to try and get three independent musicians in one place for a concert. So although I thoroughly enjoy it, I don't think it's likely to become the norm rather than the exception. But it is a joy to be able to sit back and watch somebody else work for a change too.
Well, as a performer, how do you think that for you and for the audience, how do you think those two kinds of performances are different? One where you come out on the stage and you do the whole thing, and where you have two other performers with you.
Ah, that's a hard one. Excuse me. Sorry, Mike. The positive side of it, of course, is that the audience is being exposed to a much wider range of Scottish music than I can offer on my own. The fact that, you know, the fiddle is very, very closely allied to the sung tradition, particularly when you're dealing with Burns songs, because he used so many fiddle tunes to set songs to. The fact that 18th century fiddle music was scored in so many cases to be accompanied by cello, and you never hear that, where Alistair and Abby do a beautiful job of that. And the formal arrangements, again, along the lines of, you know, sound English, more people will find you acceptable. This is nothing new. In Burns' time, at the end of the 18th century, is when a lot of these Scottish traditional songs were set by the European composers, because the editors who invited Haydn and Beethoven to do it were aware that it would broaden their market, that it would, in quotes, improve the songs. And I can't do a Haydn setting, obviously, as a solo singer. I need the instrumentals. So there's a much broader range possible. Sometimes, depending on how much adrenaline I'm pumping and how the audience is responding, I regret the ability to take them where I want them to go for 2 hours, because if you get up not having seen that group of people before, and they are responsive if they're live, you can do almost anything you want with them. You can, and since I am proselytizing in a sense, I can cover a tremendous amount of territory, get them to sing, get them to listen, hopefully get them to laugh, get them to weep, get them to do all sorts of things. And just in terms of playing time, to do 40 minutes solo and then join the others, there is a structure superimposed on working with two other people that is not there with a solo act. So it's a different experience for me as well. It's a different experience for the audience. I don't think it's better or worse. It's just different. I don't think that's desperately articulate. Hmm. What I've boiled down to saying, I think, is that since there are three people involved, we have to have a program, we have to have a running order. We know how long it lasts. I can't run off at the mouth quite as long as I might if I were just picking it out of the air, so that it's considerably more structured, but then the content is wider and there's a lot more variety.
All right. Well, we will talk with someone else here on our toll-free line once again. Hello.
Yes, indeed. Just can't help but express how much we enjoyed the frequency with which we had a chance to hear your guest on Prairie Home Companion, and wondering if there's any other sort of outlet that we can dependably turn to hear her contribution.
Not as far as the media is concerned, I don't think, at the moment. There isn't another program running right now that I'm a steady guest on. I guess the answer is no, unfortunately. I'm bouncing around the continent quite a bit doing concerts, but that's a very different thing. Unless I show up in your hometown, it's no help to you at all.
Right. Well, it's been such a loss for us. We enjoyed it. You know, it was one of those things we could depend upon with some regularity, and we just really have have missed it. Hope you find some outlet that will benefit us with that contribution.
Well, thank you so much. You're doing wonders for my flagging morale this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you. Perhaps I should mention again, in case anybody doesn't know, that Jean has recorded a number of record albums, so if she doesn't pop up on your radio, you certainly can put her on your turntable and listen that way. Something else I was curious about, it was my understanding that for a long time you were very resistant to the idea of doing a compact disc. And I know that you have one. Oh, now you're looking at me like, what? No, I didn't think I was. I thought that for a long time you didn't want to do it. That's not true.
No, I know I have always resisted the notion of a live recording, but CDs, no. I mean, it's I'm happy to put music on, you know, plastic lettuce leaves if that's the way the technology is going. Don't think I had any strong feelings about CD at all. As a matter of fact, I think the next thing down the pike is a CD of the very early Elektra records, which were made between 61 and 64. Mm-hmm. And seems to me that makes perfect sense. You know, the technology is such that you can clean up masters that have been around for a long time and make them fit to listen to again. You're not condemned to that scratchy, echoey sound that we associate with Caruso and things like that. But no, I don't think I ever had any resistance to a CD, but I still feel fairly strongly about live recordings.
Why is that?
There is an immediacy, a spontaneity, and an intimacy in a hall that I think is really only the right and just property of the people who are there at the moment. And although a song will wear repetition, obviously, with any luck, one never sings the same song exactly the same way twice running. It stands to reason that you can listen to a song as I do many times. I can listen to the same cut 14 times in a row if I'm in the process of learning it. I don't think the same thing is true of spoken introductions, of one-liners. I mean, obviously, every performer has as wide a repertoire of introductions and one-liners, and I hate to say jokes because I'm not thinking so much of jokes as introductions that are aimed at changing a mood in a certain direction, and I don't think these wear well at all. Basically, it boils down to almost everything else I do. It's subjective. I don't like listening to live recordings. I find the chatter, the applause, the stuff in between intrusive, and I don't think that the atmosphere that is captured as a result of a live recording compensates for that at all. So since I feel that way about listening to them, I don't have any desire or feel any pressure to make one, although it's been mentioned many a time. I can't see why.
Yeah. I wish we had more time. The time went quickly, as I knew it would, so I'm afraid we'll just have to leave it at that and say, the next time you come back to Champaign Urbana, we'll welcome you back if you would have us again.
Certainly.
Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Jean Redpath.